of the Joint House Ways and Means Committee and Senate Finance Committee meeting. Members, we're going to make a slight change in the order. I'm not going to take up the jobs and energy bill first. I understand there's a lot of people here that have interest in the other bills. There's just a few technical corrections that have been made to the other bills. So after a few announcements here, we're going to go through those quickly, and then we'll spend the rest of our time on the jobs and energy bill. Just a reminder for people that were here last time, these bills are technically not before us, so there are no amendments or other voting in order. That will happen when we actually have the special session start and new special session bills are introduced, so no action can be taken tonight. I'll be chairing the part of the meeting connected with the jobs and energy bill. Senator Cohen will chair the sort of technical correction part, and we have to be out of this room by 6 o'clock tonight for caucuses, and so we want to make good use of our time. And with that, I'm going to turn things over to Senator Cohen.
Okay, thanks, Representative Knobloch. So we're going to, as Representative Knobloch indicated, start with the what we think is a technical corrections bill. Now, in terms of staff to present that to us, so I don't think we have Senate and House authors, but Mr. Do we have the bill available, and do we have this? Mr. Nauman, you had indicated maybe we are going to revert back to.
I understand that there are 25 copies of those other bills available if people feel the need to actually see them. Just a moment.
All right. Okay. So, we were just touching base. So, staff is going to go through the bills that we have in front of us. Why don't we start with education then? So that would be. All right.
I think maybe.
Yeah. So we got Mr. Strom, and do we have
141? Welcome, Trump.
Yeah. Or Mr. Strom, here's Mr. Arneson. So the two of you will tell us what we have, and that's what incorporated in what we have in front of us. Is that correct? Okay. Now we're all on the same page. So whoever's going to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, just one small change from the education bill from when you saw it last week. I made a drafting error. The word prior should be there, prior year instead of current year, in part of the special education formula. All of the runs, the spreadsheets, the department understanding was all based on using the word prior, so that change pulls the bill into line with how everyone was interpreting it. And that's the only change, Mr. Chair, in the K-12 bill.
Okay. Thank you. Unless there are questions, Rivers and Carlson?
Yeah, just a question now. Will these omnibus bills be drafted with these changes in the bills as they're introduced tomorrow? Or are they going to be carried in the corrections bill or the revisers bill, as we sometimes call it?
Mr. Strom, did you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, this change is included in the posted version that you see in front of you online now, so it's already included in the bill that will be introduced.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chairman, is that true of the other items on the list, then, that they will be incorporated in the omnibus bill and the revisers bill will have other separate issues included?
That's my sense, but, okay, I'm getting a nod from Mr. Bonner, Mr. Nauman. I don't know on the House side if we have, Mr. Marks, Mr. Shepard to confirm that. Okay. All right, so thank you. So how about environment?
Not my shit I want to. Let them deal.
Whoever's going to jump in.
Mr. Chair, you want me to start?
Sure, Mr. Cohen.
The only change to the Ag, Environment, and Natural Resources bill that you'll find in the bill posted on the 10th is the language that Representative McNamara talked about, the up to. Okay. $2.5 million and then deleting the and airstripping and inserting the Article A. So that's the change in at this point in time, but my understanding is there's a further change, and I think Ms. Taylor might be want to help us with that.
And before we continue, there should be within each bill folder a very brief summary. Is that prepared, Mr. Bodern? This is on Senate stationery. Is that what's in everybody's bill? Okay. So this has the language proposed for ag and environment. Is that correct?
Correct. And then, Mr. Chair, as Mr. Knopf mentioned, there's another change that's not incorporated in the revised posted bill that will be posted, I believe, later this evening, perhaps. And that there will be two parts of that. One will be to increase the amount of the CLIF repayment to $63.2 million, and this is basically just taking what was proposed in the jobs bill and including it in the environment bill. And then, so the change would be on the page 97 of the bill. It would just revise that amount. And then additionally, if you remember the discussion from last week on the repayment with the November forecast, the same amount or the same process will be used to pay the $8.1 million that was transferred from the MLCAT or the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Action Trust account, and that will be incorporated in the new draft.
Okay, thank you. Questions, Representative Mahoney?
And it's not to this particular bill, it's kind of the process bill. Now, I pulled the jobs and energy bill off the internet, or had my staff do it for me sometime around noon. So I'm wondering, what bill am I going to be looking at? I mean, there was a new bill posted at 359 or something like that, so I've got it all marked up and ready to ask about it. So, I'm 4 hours early on my bill. So what bill am I going to be using here? Because I've got some questions.
Well, so far our staff has indicated that the changes are technical, and I would suggest maybe we could wait till we get the economic development bill, and then we'll make sure at the front end we know what's there. Because we could skip to that staff if you'd like us to right now.
No, I don't want you to skip to it. I just was wondering on all these bills if they were just posted at...
Well, what we've been told is that these changes have been incorporated into the draft we have in front of us.
Senator Cohen, if I could.
Representative Nava.
Yeah, the bills that we're going through now, Representative Mahoney and others, we're really just looking at changes that have come up that are technical in nature since we had the hearing last week on the three bills, the education bill, the ag environment bill, and the bonding bill. And so that's all we're talking about right now. The economic development bill that you're referencing, which we'll go through after these three technical changes, that, of course, we didn't do last week. And I guess I can't honestly tell you off the top of my head the answer to your question, but we have paper copies of those bills available, and we'll pass one out to you, Representative Mahoney. I can direct staff to get you one, and you can see if it's the same one as the one you marked up for your questions.
Mr. Chair, that would be fine, but the problem is that we've got 2 hours to do a bill, and if you're posting a bill at 3:45 for a 4 o'clock hearing, it's a little difficult to get ready for a bill in 15 minutes, a 103-page bill. So we'll certainly take a look, but we may have a further discussion when these three are done.
All right. Senator Cohen.
Okay. Anything further on the environment and ag bill?
Mr. Chair, not on that one, no.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You wanted to go to the legacy bill, though. There are a couple of changes in that.
Okay, certainly.
Mr. Chair, there was just some technical corrections dealing with the clean water article. And it's on page 42. There was the word article is on line 31. The word article is deleted and paragraph inserted. And then there was a sentence deleted that it was conflicting on the availability of the appropriation on page 42, line 34. That has to do with the ag water quality certification. And that's a technical. And then also another technical in there, there was a correction made on the numbers on page 72 dealing with the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks. And what the numbers were taken from the wrong bill. And so it doesn't match with it. Didn't match with the spreadsheet, and so now the new numbers, the right numbers are included. It's on page 72, line 10. It's $8,618,000 the first year and $9,033,000 the second year, which lines up with the spreadsheet. It also lines up with the totals in the bill. So that's been fixed also.
Okay, thank you. Questions on the legacy bill? Okay, anything else? All right, thank you. And I think that would leave the capital investment bill. Ms. James, you're...
Mr. Chair and members, there are just four small changes to the bonding bill that was posted today as compared to the bill that the committee, that this joint committee looked at last week. First of all, on page 4, lines 1 through 13, the Canby and Jackson campus projects for Minsky are now combined in an amount. They, in the last version, they each had a specific amount that was, and those amounts were transposed. So that's fixed. The second one is on page 16, lines 11 through 16. The description of the Fort Snelling project is changed to reflect the amount that was appropriated for that project that will only cover pre-design. The third item is on page 22, lines 9, 10, and 12. These are corrections to the cross-references within the Lewis and Clark section to make the definitions make sense. And the fourth item is on page 44, lines 13 through 21. The name of the lock that was closed is changed, is fixed.
Okay. Questions from the committee on the capital investment bill? Okay, seeing none, thank you. So I think that concludes the bills that we'd reviewed last week, so Representative Knobloch.
Well, if I could have the individuals associated with the Jobs and Energy and Economic Development Bill come forward, in particular staff Anita Newman and Harriet Hendricks. I think we're going to have staff walk through the Jobs and Economic Development Bill. And I guess to your question, Representative Mahoney, I've checked with staff, and the bill that you saw on the web that was posted apparently around noon, I don't know the exact time, is the bill that we're going through. I think there may have been another one posted by the Senate or a later posting by the Senate, but we're going through the one that you marked up, right, is my understanding. So welcome to the committee. Ms. Newman, Ms. Hendricks, who would like to start first in terms of going through and pointing out the differences between this bill and the bill, the original conference committee bill that was passed?
Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, I'll be working off the spreadsheet that says at the top as of 6/10/2015, 3:10 p.m., and I'll refer to the column that is kind of the second column next to special session column for fiscal year 16 and 17. So the first column next to that is the one that compares the bill to base, and then the second one is it compares it to the vetoed bill, Chapter 80. So that's the column that I'll be referring to because that highlights the differences between the vetoed bill and the bill that is in front of you.
Thank you, Ms. Hendricks. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and the first two pages will have show the summary of the bill for the general fund and by department, and then after that there's the detail on all the agencies within the bill. So the Department of Employment Economic Development on line 4 is getting an extra additional $2.5 million in general fund appropriations, $2.5 million for Minnesota Housing, 76 for Bureau of Mediation Services, line 8, $13,774,000 for the Department of Commerce, for a total of additional direct appropriations from the general fund of $18.15 million. no changes in statutory appropriations. And then there's the overview of the general fund revenues. I won't go through every single change, but the change between the vetoed bill and this bill in front of you is an additional $15.854 million in general fund revenue. And then the final line on that first page has the net general fund impact. Second page shows the changes in direct appropriations by fund. So again, change the general fund appropriations, and then workforce development fund lowered by $2 million, and the workers' compensation fund an additional $10.324 million. So starting on page three, all the detail for the agencies. The italicized items are the ones that are changed items. The above that is are the base riders. So on the first page, there are no changes, no numbers in that particular column. On page four, I won't go through every single change because they all refer to changes that are due to the moving around of appropriations. So this is not additional funding or reductions. This means that certain appropriations were moved from certain subdivisions within DEED to other subdivisions, and they show up as changes in the spreadsheet. So on page five, there's a reduction in the appropriation to the St. Cloud Area Somali Salvation Organization. That's line 189 of $180,000. That is added to Big Brothers Big Sisters on line 194. The following are all changes that are due to, the moving around of appropriations from different subdivisions, but no new money or no reductions in appropriations. On page six, on line 257, there's an additional $2 million for individual placement services for persons with mental illness. On line 262, there's an additional $500,000 for extended employment. On page 7, there's an increase in the Bridges Program under Minnesota Housing Finance. That's on line 328 of $2.5 million. On line on page 8, there are no changes. On to page 9, at the top on line 402, there is $10 million for the workers' comp IT system modernization within the Department of Labor and Industry. This is from the workers' comp fund. On page 10, on line 472, there's an operating adjustment for the Bureau of Mediation Services of $76,000 for the biennium. Going down to line 491, there's a compensation adjustment for the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals. This is from the Workers' Comp Fund, $324,000 added to the bill. On page 11, on line 529, there is a operating adjustment for Department of Commerce of $287,000. Going down to line 543 and 544, this is dividing up in appropriation, and half of the appropriation is now going to MINUT. The fiscal impact is the net fiscal impact is zero here. And then at the bottom of that page, on line 558, there is additional appropriation from the general fund for the healthcare enforcement under Department of Commerce of $558,000 for the biennium. Going down to page 12. On line 586, there's an appropriation for energy-intensive trade-exposed rate activities. This appropriation is offset by a general fund revenue through an assessment, so that would be on the first page. You would find that assessment. On line 589, there is an assessment that was set to sunset at the end of this fiscal year, and that has been renewed for 2 years, so the sunset is now at the end of fiscal year 17. This is also offset by an assessment, but then in the special revenue fund, so that's $800,000. Going to page 13, on line 614, there's an additional appropriation for health insurance rate review staffing of $1.284 million for the biennium. On line 616, there's a $91,000 appropriation for the No-Fault Auto Insurance Task Force. Then on line 14, under non-general fund revenue, you'll find the assessment due to the sunset date change on line 684. And then on line 693, the vetoed bill had a change to the trailer registration, and that provision has been removed, so that change to the to this fund is no longer there. And then there's the transfer from Cliff into the general fund on 694. And if that concludes all the changes from the Chapter 80 compared to the bill in front of you.
All right, members of the committee, before we go on to Ms. Newman, why don't I just ask if there's any questions that people have for Ms. Hendricks. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hendricks, I have two questions. The first one is, and it's one that you and I have talked about a lot over the last week, can you tell me what, in the Workforce Development Fund, we've talked about the carry forward or the rollover or whatever. We spend a lot of money out of that particular fund, and we have pretty consistently left a significant dollar figure for emergencies. Can you tell me what it is per year and then total it for the biennium? What's left in that fund after all these carve outs?
Well, Ms. Hendricks.
Representative Mahoney and members of the committee, I think the best place to look for this information is on page 2. On line 56, that's the summary for the Workforce Development Fund. If you look at the column next to the first three columns that indicate special session, it compares the bill to the base. So this bill spends a little over $13 million more than what is the base budget for the Workforce Development Fund.
Representative Mahoney, go ahead, Ms. Hendricks.
The expected revenues into the fund for the next year, for fiscal year 2016, are about $50 million. So for fiscal year 16, that would leave about $22.5 million for what is the dislocated worker program. Anything that's not directly appropriated from this fund is appropriated to this program. I think if you look at historical trends, that is lower than what is typically left for this program, which is typically around $30 million. And again, the base budget is about $20 million. And the same would be true for fiscal year 17.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Ms. Hendricks. So, if the historically they've spent 30, and we're leaving 22, does that mean there's an $8 million left, or we're taking $8 million more out of this particular fund and leaving? What would be the historical ongoing dollar figure typically left? Would it be $2 million? Would it be 7 or 12 like we normally do, or what?
Ms. Hendricks.
Representative Mahoney, members of the committee, it's something that maybe the agency could shed a little bit more light on if they wanted to. Since I think the revenues into the fund are pretty volatile because they come in through assessments and a tax, so depending on that, there might be more money left in the fund this next coming fiscal year or less if the economy went down. But I think, again, if you look historically, it's been around $20 million of direct appropriations from the fund for the last, say, two or three biennia. So this bill, having $27.5 million out of in fiscal year 16, is about $7.5 million more, which then by default means about $7.5 million less for the dislocated worker program.
Thank you. I still don't have the full answer that I was looking for, but I think I'll get it from the department before the night's over. Then the other piece is on my other question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Mahoney.
you talked about the energy intense trade affected piece in the bill at $483 million. Where is that where is that money coming from? And is it coming from the, well, where is that money coming from?
Ms. Hendricks.
Okay. Representative Mahoney, members of the committee, if I understand you correctly, your question is there is a direct appropriation to Commerce for this, the activities related to energy-intensive trade-exposed rate setting. That would be offset by an assessment that Commerce will conduct on the utility, as I understand, a utility that applies for these rates.
Thank you, Mahoney.
That should do it. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going back to line 558 that you pointed out to us as a change, healthcare enforcement funding, I just was curious about what that is. Or maybe you could direct me in the bill to where, if it's in the bill.
Did you say line 558?
Line 558 on the spreadsheet.
All right. Ms. Hendricks.
Representative Liebling and members of the committee, so that line, it's on page 28, lines 28.25 and 28.26 of the bill, and it is funding that is currently paid out of other sources that ends at the end of this fiscal year, so these the general fund appropriation would supplement that, or not supplement, it takes on that particular purpose of expired funds and now coming out of the general fund.
Representative Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I maybe you're a couple steps ahead of me. Just can you just tell me what is being enforced there and who that money goes to for what enforcement activity? That's kind of what I'm looking for. Okay.
Ms. Hendricks or Ms. Newman?
Commerce is here.
Members of the committee, Representative Liebling, I know that there's two. There's the healthcare enforcement funding, and then there's also the health insurance rate review. I would have to ask if there's anyone from Commerce probably to kind of explain exactly what the difference is between these two items. And
okay. Is there anyone from Commerce here that can answer that question?
And Mr. Chair, just while he's
Representative
up,
Liebling.
I think I understand the rate review piece. I just, this piece, healthcare enforcement funding, I just was not familiar with that, not sure what it's referring to.
Okay. Hello, sir. Welcome to the Joint Committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Representative Liebling, this budget item was included in the Governor's budget recommendations for the Commerce Department. It is funding for existing positions at the department that are in our enforcement division, specifically working on healthcare issues. So this, as members well know, we've had a different world the last couple of years in health insurance. And there has been a proliferation in that new world of new consumer issues that have arisen to the department. So this ranges from issues that consumers themselves are having with their health insurance, but also working with enforcement issues that deal with how consumers access the marketplace, so dealing with agents and brokers and consumer issues themselves and whether or not they qualify for particular types of assistance. So we've had a very successful program. I think the last count that I had was over 160 cases over the last 18 months to 24 months alone that have been successfully resolved. So these positions were funded with a grant that is a federal grant that is set to expire at the end of the current state fiscal year, and so the Commerce, in order to continue to do this work, needed ongoing funding.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And that certainly sounds like very important activity. I'm glad we're funding it. I think it's just the terminology here that kind of threw me, because it says health care enforcement rather than, probably should say, health insurance related activities or something. But thank you for that explanation.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, sir. Senator Champion.
Thank you so very much. And maybe Ms. Hendricks or someone can answer this question for me. I was looking through the spreadsheet, and usually under or next to what I see as line 160, is the OICs, and there's usually another line that was in the past bill for the Emerging Workforce Coalition, which is a cross-section of Latinos, African Americans, just a number of people across the state that has been working on workforce, and I don't see that provision anymore, and so I'm wondering, is it somewhere in the bill, or has the funds been reallocated someplace, because I don't see it anymore.
Ms. Hendricks.
Members of the committee, that actually I skipped over that item. I was just alerted to, and so that item was in the vetoed bill on line 205, but that is no longer in the bill that is in front of you. So under change items on 205, the Emerging Workforce Coalition, you can see was funded at $2 million in the Chapter 80, but not in the current bill.
And so,
Senator.
And so can you tell me where the $2 million went to? Like, I know earlier you talked about where money was reallocated and taken for some other purpose. Can you tell me where the $2 million went to?
Ms. Hendricks.
Members of the committee, I would have to defer to someone else on that particular question, because that I would not know. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Is Mr. Chair, is there someone else that can speak to that and tell us that? Because I think that would be important for us to know.
I don't know. Representative Garofalo or Senator Tomassoni, do you have any knowledge on this particular issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion, as you look through the spreadsheet, you'll see that there are other items that received increases in funding. I think you could take a look at any of those items that received an increase over the vetoed bill, say that's where the $2 million went.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Tomassoni,
I'm confused as to why this one was dropped myself, but I'm fairly certain that the $2 million is workforce development funds, and it just dropped to the bottom line. So I don't exactly know why it was taken out, and I would love to have someone give me an explanation also, because I think this one was worthwhile.
All right. Other questions for Ms. Hendricks? Ms. Hendricks, if I could, and then I'll recognize Representative Mahoney, I just want to verify, I'd ask someone, had someone ask me about this, is there any additional funding for state services for the blind in this new bill as compared to the original conference committee bill? Ms. Hendricks.
Representative Knobloch and members of the committee, that particular item has not changed, so that is on line 264, employment support services for the deaf, blind, hard of hearing, that was funded at $2 million in the Chapter 80, the vetoed bill, and it's at the same level of funding in the bill in front of you.
Thank you, Ms. Hendricks. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, with today's modern media, someone must be watching, and I got a text that you know, typically we leave anywhere from $10 million when we were in the depths of a $5 billion shortfall with Governor Pawlenty back in 2004, where we left about $10 million in the workforce rollover money for emergencies for unemployed people. And this year, we're going to leave 2.9 per year, or just under $6 million. So with a $1 billion surplus, we have taken from unemployed people, the money we use to train unemployed people, we've taken an extra six or seven or multiple millions of dollars. I'm a little surprised that that would be the case. We took, even the worst recession we've had, we've never left less than $10 million in this rollover, and now we're down to $3 million a year. I don't know who negotiated the bill, but or who agreed to that. Maybe they didn't realize it, but that's kind of, well, I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, before I go to Ms. Newman and talk about other policy changes, are there any other questions for Ms. Hendricks on appropriations changes? Seeing none, Ms. Newman, could you walk us through the other differences between the original conference bill that was vetoed and the bill that's before us?
Mr. Chairman and members, gladly. I am working on the version of the bill that was posted yesterday. It's the 15-4541. And I will go through these rather briskly. So on page 31 of the new bill, there is language that was added to the deed workforce housing grant project to clarify that these are only for projects outside of the seven-county metro area. Mm-hmm. On pages 38 and 39, the uniform outcome reporting measurement, which is for the workforce programs.
Excuse me, I've got a question. Senator Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Ms. Newman, if you could give us the line numbers on the pages and maybe not quite so briskly.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to clarify. She's telling us new language. Is that what you're telling us?
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, yes. I'm going through only the differences from the vetoed bill. Okay, so to begin again on page 31, lines 31.11 to 31.12 and 31.14 to 31.15 is the language that clarifies that the workforce housing grants or projects are only for projects outside of the seven county metro area. Then the second item is on pages 38 and 39, lines 38.34 to 39.7. This is the Uniform Outcome Measurement and Reporting System. And this is additional language that expands this to cover all adult workforce programs that are funded with any kind of state money. And it includes programs that are administered by DEED that provide services to individuals in adult basic education and the MFIP program. Pages 45 through 49. Lines 45.27 to 49.6. This is the Customized Training for Skilled Manufacturing Industries program. The appropriation was included in the vetoed bill, but the actual program language was omitted. So this brings the program language in. On page 54, at line 54.8, this deals with the Guaranteed Asset Protection Waiver Program. And there was a requirement that the verbatim disclosures had to be both oral and written, and this the bill before you gets rid of the oral requirement, so it's just a written requirement. Ms. Hendricks mentioned that there was a provision in the now vetoed bill that it was a transportation provision on trailer weights and licensing, and that is no longer in this bill. And I'm going to skip over some of the energy stuff. Mr. Eliff is going to come up and take you through that. So I'm going to jump ahead a bit in the bill. On pages 88 and 89, lines 88.28 to 89.10, this amends some repealers for the Department of Labor and Industry that were in the Dolly housekeeping bill, which was enacted during the regular session. And there were a couple of repealers that the agency decided it needed to now unrepeal. So the statutory provision, these both deal with fee employment agencies, and the statutory provision that they want to keep in law deals with how applicant and employer information is handled and disposed of when one of these agencies ceases doing business. And the rule provision deals with the definition of these fee employment agencies. On page 97, lines 97.17 to 97.24, this is a technical clarification to the special unemployment benefits that was in the vetoed bill. The U.S. Department of Labor apparently had some objections to both naming counties and specific workers in terms of these special provisions for regular unemployment benefits. So this gets rid of the counties and the specific types of occupations and just talks about workers laid off due to adverse trade impacts. And then in the bill that's posted on pages 99 to 100, sections 1 and 2 deal with this closed landfill account payback. Those two sections are going to be stripped out of the
the bill that you'll see next, the bill that's introduced, and they are going in the environment bill. That's what Ms. Taylor talked about, the $63 million dollar payback to the closed landfill account will no longer be in this bill. And then on page 100, lines 100.16 to 100.25 is a provision that delays the operations of the PER board for 1 year until July 1st, 2016. And then in the effective date, there is some interim language that basically reinstates the current law remedies that a person that has a charge for unfair labor practices can use the district court. So that is restating current law, essentially. And then pages 100 to 104 add the destination medical center language from the House tax bill. And this whole part just clarifies the relationship between the city and the nonprofit economic development agency that's dealing with the destination medical center. And it clarifies that the definition of a public infrastructure project includes the amount that is spent on planning other than even development plan planning. So, and then in section 5 of that section, the local matching contribution is changed to provide that any city money that's spent to support the Destination Medical Center Corporation or the nonprofit EDA qualifies as a local matching contribution under the state aid program. Under current law, one half of those amounts are offset. They don't qualify as the local match. So those are all the changes in policy other than energy, and Mr. Elif will now take you through the energy changes.
Mr. Chairman. Well, before I bring up Mr. Elif, yes, Senator Latz.
Thank you. Could you go back to the change on line 100.20 to 100.25 and put that into context for me?
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, 100.20
to 0.25. Oh, the cause of action, yes. For Fair Labor Act practice.
This is under the existing 179A chapter, the PELRA. This is an existing cause of action. When PERB was enacted last year, this language was stricken from Chapter 179A as of July 1st of this year. This bill now delays the PERB changes until July 1st of 2016. And so this effective date language basically reinstates the current law remedy until the new PERB process is effective next July 1st.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, I've spoken with Auditor Otto, and she's okay with this change. So that was a joke. I'm sorry.
Let's see. I've got Senator Pappas and Senator Bonhoff. If you're done, Senator Latz.
You go ahead.
Well, if you need to clarify that point.
No, I want to clarify that.
Senator Latz, do you have a follow-up?
Well, thank you. I'm not really familiar with the PERB changes in that process, but are they still going to have a remedy in district court after those this provision expires and the new provisions take effect?
Oh, Representative Garofalo?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, what will happen is basically the remedy that's available will be extended for another year because of the funding and policy changes that are not contained in the bill. It would have put people in legal limbo. So then that is something that will happen a year from now would be either the PERD board would have to be funded with the policy changes or they would have to be rescinded and this corrective measure would have to be put back in place to make it the way it used to be.
So the new, Mr.
Senator Latz.
Representative Garofalo, so the new provisions, when they eventually take effect, if the proper things are enacted to make that happen, will that be just an administrative remedy, or will they still have the option of going to district court to enforce the unfair labor practice?
No,
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, as I look at the language, I believe you'll see this is effective January 1 of 2016. Right. So it's what the intent of the original.
Yeah, but there's a sentence yep. right here.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Newman.
Senator Latz, in the new PURB statute, which will take effect now next July instead of this July, an appeal of the PURB board decision would go to the Court of Appeals, and that is in the new PURB law.
Right. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Senator
Pappas. As long as we're talking about PURB, so tell me it. Is funded or is not funded in here, or it's delayed funded, and what about the privacy language that they needed to operate?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, the request from the from the agency was to increase their funding above the $125,000 a year they had. That is not contained in the bill, nor is the policy language you reference.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, so in other words, since they couldn't operate without the policy language change, you put the previous law into effect with a delayed expiration date of 2016.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, if you mean by giving them $125,000 a year and keeping the law in place with those exceptions, your statement would be correct.
Let me Senator ask that Pappas. Question again. So the law was to create the PURB board and fund it as an alternative to court, but they couldn't operate because they weren't able to go into executive session to discuss sensitive things. Okay, so they in the original bill that was passed, I don't believe they were granted the privacy language nor the additional operating money. So what you are doing in this bill is simply reinstating the previous law that they can go to court to resolve conflicts? Ms. Newman?
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, this bill continues the PURB funding at $125,000 a year. It doesn't have any of the data privacy language, and it delays the full-scale implementation of PURB until next year.
Senator Bonner, just one question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is Representative Garofalo or Senator Tomasoni. I don't know if he's sitting there. I can't see. There. Oh, thank you. So they kind of glossed over in the going through the bill the fact that we are now not adopting that change to the Hennepin County landfills. I'm very grateful for that. I know people will in my community will be grateful, but can you just elaborate a little more about that?
Representative Garofalo.
Chairman Senator Bonhoff, what are you talking about?
That that now the landfill money, the excess funds that previously in the bill that we had before us, you were capturing that money and using it in other ways, and now that will be paid back in this bill. Is that what I understand?
Well, Representative Garofalo, I think that otherwise Ms. Newman had addressed that earlier.
Right, so I just wanted to clarify and get more information.
All right. Representative McNamara will probably answer.
Yeah, it's maybe I can recognize Representative McNamara, because I think this is actually an environment issue. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, it was the nonpartisan staff went through it earlier when they did the environment bill. That's now projected. Are you talking about the mill cap one? Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I'm talking about the Hennepin County landfill monies that were taken out of that fund that now are going to be repaid.
Oh, all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
I think Senator Bonhoff is talking about the mill cap, and that was not proposed when we had the joint hearing last week to be repaid.
And in now
the environment
is.
Bill, now it will be repaid when there's a positive surplus, which is under current projections would happen in November. That is similar to CLIP. That's the mill cap one.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman?
Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, just to be clear, there's it's written in this bill, but it's going to be taken out of this bill, and it's going to be put into the environment bill, so it won't be contained in this bill anymore.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Thompson, I thank you, because I knew I saw it in here, and it was addressed in here, and so then people were addressing it like it wasn't in here, so thank you for clarifying this.
Are there other questions for Ms. Oh, yes, Representative Carlson.
I was actually had my hand up on the PIRB board, so I want to go back to that just briefly. Maybe somebody can clarify it, but I was the original author on the House side when we set this up, and then we had the data privacy issue that surfaced this session. And I thought there were two levels. One was the investigative level, and the other was when the board would go into executive session to discuss it. So I'm curious as to what, now that we're going with current law, what the status is of investigations and the data privacy issues that would surround that. Has anybody got the answer to that? If by delaying it a year, do we have a privacy or data privacy question?
Who would like to take that question?
I think it would be best if we had BMS come down and explain it.
All right.
Because I think the earlier testimony, Mr. Chairman, was that current law relative to the executive session, but it didn't address the question of the investigative process and how much of that would be public.
Okay. Welcome, sir, to the Joint Committee. Can you give us your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Hi, I'm Josh Tilson. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services.
And, sir, did you hear Representative Carlson's question, or would you like him to repeat it?
I did. I mean, I can sort of explain what happened here. I don't know who knew about what happened, but when the original bill was passed, there was only enough funding put in there for them to basically open up their office and do rulemaking, which they've been doing since they were created last year. And there really wasn't enough funds for them to actually operate that was put in the bill in 2014. And when there was no additional funds put in this year, we were sort of left scrambling trying to figure out what they were going to do. They talked about a bunch of different options, and the option was this one-year delay. So at the same time, they identified this problem with the Data Practices Act, which is really a serious problem for them. There's only three members on this board. They need to do a lot of private conversations about what's going on with personnel matters and what's going on with internal matters to the board while they're deliberating on cases. And they asked to have this data practices change, and particularly the change in the open meetings. Actually, I think the open meetings change was more critical than the data practices change, because there's some protections in current law and data practices. But the open meetings just made them really they're still crippled by the lack of the open meetings. They can't really meet in private to talk about, to deliberate. So that's the situation.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I think that part of it I understood from the earlier comments, but when I had some conversations when I introduced the bill this session, part of that I thought was the privacy and the information from the investigative side when you're investigating an issue. Or is that all one and the same?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, they're not one and the same, no. There are two separate issues. One is data practices, one is open meetings. And on data practices, as I just said, there's some protections in data practices, and besides the fact that it's delayed means that they're not going to be dealing with employee personnel data for the next year until July of 2016. I'm hopeful that if this is reintroduced next year, they'll have an opportunity to deliberate on it and make the change. The open meetings thing is, as I said, I feel more crippling because there's just a lot of deliberations they can't do because they're doing them in public. So that's
Representative Carlson. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Sir, thank you. Okay. Yes, Representative Birdall, you can take a chair up here if you want. Other questions? Otherwise, we'll go to the energy provisions. All right. Go ahead, sir. Can you please state your name for the record and go through the energy provisions of the bill that we haven't talked about yet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Ela for the House Research Department. The energy provision changes begin on page 68, and on lines 1 to 14 on that page, in sections 14 to 16, are three new definitions that are added, definitions of propane, propane storage facility, and synthetic gas. The next change is on page 75, on lines 21 through 26. This is a technical change. You'll notice on line 74.25, there's reference to a new paragraph F. Unfortunately, that paragraph was omitted in Chapter 80. This change merely reinstates that paragraph on those lines on page 75. The next new change is on Section 23 on pages 77 to 78, beginning on line 77.27. This extends for 2 years to June 30th, 2017, the Department of Commerce's existing authority to assess utilities for the department's costs in representing the interests of Minnesota ratepayers before regional, national, and international bodies that make energy policy decisions. The next change is also on page 78, section 24, lines 5 through 12. This requires the Commissioners of Commerce and Pollution Control to submit to the legislature for review and comment the draft plan that's required by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency that details actions the state will take to meet its EPA-determined greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals. And finally, on page 81, lines 8 to 11, is new language in section 26 that authorizes the Commissioner of Commerce to assess utilities proposing an energy-intense trade-exposed rate to the Public Utilities Commission for the department's cost in assisting the commission in reviewing the utilities application. This is the subject of Representative Mahoney's questions a few minutes ago. They have assessment authority to replace the money that's appropriated from the general fund for those purposes.
All right. Any questions on these provisions from anyone? Representative Mahoney.
I'm not sure I'm on the correct bill. But on the, I think it's page, on my bill, 78, line 5, legislative review, and I just want to be sure I understand. That's the 111D proposal from the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's correct.
And Mr. Chair, maybe the testifier can clarify. That is... shall policy for review and comment, and it's not an up or down vote, it's or anything, it's just a review and comment on the particular plan, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Steven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, so on the EITE rate language, could you again clarify, and I'm just reading through it, so I think this is the case, but in an earlier iteration of the bill, oil refineries would be eligible for a rate reduction. Can you clarify that that's not the case under this language that's before us?
But Mr. Ehrlich?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, that's correct. Oil refineries were taken out.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pappas and then Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. I just want to clarify, since we're looking at this very quickly, is a hydroelectric eligible under this definition?
Mr. Ehrlich.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, the facilities that are eligible for these new rates are manufacturing facilities that meet the requirements on essentially on page 80 at the top of the page, regardless of what their energy source might be.
Representative Mahoney.
So, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to take it as this is the time to question the bill. And I'm on that same energy-intensive trade affected piece to the bill. Page 80, as you were just speaking to, the who is eligible under this? I mean, I see iron mining, extraction and processing facilities. I'm not sure what scrap mining is, but that's okay. Someone, I'm sure, will tell me. Paper mills, wood products, manufacturers, sawmills, oriented strand board. Who's all included in this? Because this, I'm just trying to figure out, is is a retailer because they import from China, a trade-related industry. There's a, I'm not clear on that. So if someone can clear that up for me, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Ehrlich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, as you said, the industries that are specifically listed there are included on lines 80.6 to 80.11. There's, in essence, a catch-all category that would include facilities that meet the three conditions that are posed there, and all those three conditions apply to facilities that use a great deal of energy a great deal of the time of the day. I'm not sure if you're asking me specifically if retailers might qualify.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, a supermarket uses a significant amount of energy to keep its product cool and frozen, lights on, heated. Could a supermarket fall underneath this particular because they import meats, they import vegetables, they import products, and they are affected by a trade cost? Would they come underneath this? Because that's certainly the way I would read it, or a good lawyer at $600 an hour would interpret it.
Mr. Ehrlich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney. Obviously, any facility that meets the condition of number four would qualify. I think I might argue with respect to a grocery store that it's not subject to globally competitive pressures in terms of where its customers can shop, and therefore might not meet it, but your $600 an hour lawyer might have a different view.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
But if I'm a lathe operator or a machine shop that sells HVAC systems to India to cool the barns for their milking production, they would come underneath it.
Mr. Ehrlich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, if they met the other conditions required here, maybe the most important one is this peak electrical demand of at least 10,000 kilowatts, which is a pretty high number.
Okay. I think there's going to be a... Mr. Chair, if I could continue.
Mahoney.
This is really bad.
Can anyone give me an idea of how much this is going to cost the little old lady or the young family with kids of an increase, percentage, or dollar figure on their energy costs, their utility bill? Because if you give somebody a discount, somebody else is picking it up.
Geothermal.
Can somebody tell me how much this is going to cost the average ratepayer?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, first of all, off the top, it appears that there's going to be an extra $854,000 of assessments. So that's the first thing in there. Second of all, it's going to be entirely dependent upon, number one, the number of businesses that apply for the status. Number two, what discount, if any, they are given that is approved by the Public Utilities Commission. And then third and finally, what the rate base is of the utility that it's making that change in. I think a good analogy to this would be the tax committee. For example, when we change classification rates, we are not lowering or raising taxes. This is not making energy more affordable. What we're doing is we're shifting who is paying that. And so under the current model, many of these users are actually paying more than their cost for the system. And so what that amount is going to be and who it's going to be, it's going to be entirely dependent upon the businesses. I will tell you this, Representative Mahoney, that whatever that amount is, it pales in comparison to if these businesses close and 100% of that burden is shifted onto ratepayers.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask this. I do have some concerns about this because this right now as it stands is at 200,000 or less retail customers. If a large company on the, because this is geared towards the top, the northern 20 or 25% of the state, I don't know exactly the rate areas of Minnesota Power or Otter Tail, so I'll just use that number. This is a real, as one of the former speakers used to say, this is the nose of the camel underneath the tent for the rest of the state. And anybody that gets any any retail electrical user would, I mean, if I'm one of the Fortune 500 companies down here in the metro area, they use a lot of energy for my office building, I might like this particular discount. So everyone should be aware that this is coming farther south sooner or later. I know. So are you telling me, though, here's my question for Representative Garofalo or Senator Tomasoni. Now, any of these rate schedules, anything that has to change has to go through and be approved by the Public Utility Commission, correct?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got other questions on the bill. Is this the time, or I'm happy to let other people jump in between me?
Yeah, let's go on. I've got Representative Murphy here, and then I'll come back to you, Representative Mahoney, and I, Representative Kahn, and I guess I think if we're done with, I think we're maybe done with Mr. Ehrlich specifically. I can also ask. I can also ask the authors to talk about the bill. But let me go to Representative Murphy and then Kahn. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo or Mr. Ehrlich. on page 80, from 1-4, are these existing businesses and industries, or are they? If somebody else came in, would they apply? Would it apply to them?
Mr. Ehrlich.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy.
It's Eloff. It's Bob Eloff. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I blew it. All right, sorry, Mr. Eloff.
You look so much alike.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for correcting me.
This would apply to both existing and future companies that met the criteria.
Representative Kahn.
This is an issue which is a little bit off the bill because apparently it was in the original Senate bill, but it was not in the original conference committee report. And I just want to bring it to the attention of the members of the body because I think it's something that's really important for us to look at. And this was for a specific grant to the Voice of East African Women's Organization to provide safe housing for victims of domestic abuse and trafficking. It was very hard to do this. And the problem is that these immigrant communities really need a different kind of care than the Minnesota majority communities do. And apparently MHFA has not been very sympathetic to this. They said that they've had their they're moving away from shelters. They're really moving into trying to get people fixed in the neighborhood. But this does not work out for these communities that have very difficult arrangements, particularly for the women in them. And I understand that we're not ready to have new amendments being made to this bill at this time. But I think it's something that we really need to put on the agenda. I think we've also talked about that maybe not only the East African communities, but maybe the Hmong community and so forth might need something here. And we're not looking at a lot of money. Apparently there was the start of doing something in the city of St. Paul. There is a location, I think it's in Representative Moran's district, there is a location in St. Paul that they've been working on, and then suddenly somebody came in with a whole bunch of more requirements that pushed the cost way up. And so, you know, I just, you know, as I said, I wish there was the ability to make an amendment, but at this point, something I just want to bring to the members, to the attention of the members of these committees and also of the legislature. I think Senator Tomasoni knows, may even know more about it than I do. But
Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I don't think I know more about it than you do, but I do know that it was funded in the Senate bill, and I believe it was also funded in the conference committee report, but it didn't make it into this final bill. So I'm disappointed in that one also.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Eloff? Senator Dibble.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. This is back to housing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead on that point, Senator Dibble.
I'm glad Representative Kahn asked the question. I'd also heard that the capacity grants for Homeline had been removed. I was trying to understand the spreadsheet, and I can't quite make it out. There was a Homeline grant that had been Homeline, of course, provides support for renters, and they're expanding, or they had expanded their services geographically, and so there's some capacity enhancement. I'd heard that, and I just can't quite make it out, and I was a little late for the presentation.
Can someone respond to that question or comment from Senator Dibble? Ms. Hendricks.
Okay. Senator Dibble and members of the committee. So in the base budget, there were three grants, and they're on lines 319, 320, and 321. Those grants, the governor's budget or request was to remove these riders for these particular grants and then redistribute the amounts to other programs within MHFA. The current bill just drops the riders for these grants. It actually the money that's then left from after these riders were dropped is not redistributed in the sense that the governor had requested. So in line 374, it just is an unearmarked appropriation to MHFA of $445,000 each year.
Senator Dibble.
So is the implication then that they could come in and apply for those dollars?
Senator Dibble, members of the committee, that is correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that this is one of the, there's a number of people in the audience that have voiced some concerns. So I'm wondering if Bill Author or the staff could go over the changes to the net metering and what they do, how they do it, what they do, and what's the implication at the end of the day.
All right, who would like to take that? Mr. Eloff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the net metering language is on pages 74 and 75 of the bill. The new language on lines 7417 through 7422 allow cooperative electric associations or municipal utilities to charge an additional fee to recover any fixed costs from net metering customers that aren't covered by the customer's existing billing arrangement. The language says that any of these additional charges must be reasonable and appropriate for that class of customer and based on the most recent cost of service study, which needs to be made available for review by a customer, any customer of the utility upon request. Also on line 7425, you'll see that reference to paragraph F at the end of that paragraph. And paragraph F is on page 75. And what that does is allow a customer with a qualifying facility of 40 kilowatt hours or less capacity that's interconnected with a co-op or a municipal utility to may elect to be compensated for the electricity that they sell to the utility in the form of a kilowatt hour credit on their bill, which carries forward monthly and at the end of the year in December cancels at the end of the calendar year.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, I'll start at the end there. So how many 40 kilowatt customers have credits at the end of the year? Does anyone know? Or where did that number come up with? Or what's it going to cost to those folks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, you'll notice the effective date is on this section is July 1st, 2015. Applies to customers installing net meter systems after that day. It's hard to tell.
at this point?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, it may be hard to tell, but we would never put together a bill on a wing and a prayer. We would always have some documentation someplace. That was sarcasm. it's bad when you have to tell people it's sarcasm, though. Pat knows a lot about that. there's got to be some kind of idea of how many credits. I mean, you've got a list of a couple of years of people with 40 kilowatt. How many people have credits at the end of the year? You know?
Mr. Eloff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't know. But one thing I do know, which may help you a little bit, is 40 kilowatts would apply to anybody putting a solar facility on their home, certainly.
So it
and other smaller facilities.
Representative Mahoney.
Once again, we're going after the small guy. So I have a couple other questions on the net metering, and then I'll move on to the rest of the bill, if I could. The cooperative, I'm on 7417, a cooperative electric association, a municipality, municipal utility, blah, 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 collecting. What's included in this existing billing arrangement, the fixed cost? What's included in fixed cost? Is that like the HR department? Is that the transmission wires? Is that... What's included in that? And then I got some other questions on it.
Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes, it would include all those costs, that don't vary according to how much is consumed. So essentially the capital cost of the utility, all the administrative costs of the utility as well.
So interest,
Representative
payment.
Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. So it'd be interest on loans or dividends or anything like that. All of that stuff is included in what's that fixed reasonable cost is what we're calling it.
Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's correct.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
They must be reasonable and appropriate for that class of customer based on the most recent cost of service study. What does that mean? Does that mean that the PUC has a role in this, or is it the munis and the co-ops board that get to decide this?
Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, a cost of service study is done by a utility to allocate all the costs that it incurs in providing service to all its customers to its customers based on how much it costs to serve those customers. It costs a different amount for utilities to serve residential customers versus industrial customers. And what this language says is that the charge must be based on such a study.
And Representative Mahoney, the
Representative Graffalo,
the municipal and co-ops are not, with the exception of Dakota Electric, they're not rate-regulated utilities, so that would not go before the PUC.
No, that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
That brings up another question. So I have a solar panel on my house, and I'm selling it back, and all of a sudden you're charging me a fee, and I think you're full of prunes, as my mother used to say. Who do I go appeal to? Who do I take my argument to? You? Like appeal to the municipal board that set that rate, or do I have to go to court, or where?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, well, first of all, in your hypothetical, I'm assuming that you mean that you did not have a distributed generation incentive or form of generation installed before July 1st of 2015, so it would only apply to those customers who are installing these after that date. You're also assuming that you don't live in the Xcel Energy Service territory, but you actually live in one of the munis or co-ops. So based on that, we right now those boards set their rates in those areas, and so in terms of whether there's a legal remedy or not, I'm unsure, but again, right now under current law, munis and co-ops, they set their own rates.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
So there is no appealing that particular rate. There's like, if the rate's $5 or $50 or $500 a month, you're kind of out of luck if you don't like it. You just don't do it. There's no appeal. No, hey, I want you to take a look at this as a third, non-interested third party?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, it's America, so I guess you can take anything to court, but I would say that you may want to have one of the representatives of the communities or co-ops come down and talk about the current process and whether this would deviate from that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
No, I don't want to have one of the munis or co-ops people come down. I want to know if there's a remedy for a consumer to appeal this. You know, I mean, when I was having conversations with my children, they always used to go to their mother to get a third independent opinion. But I didn't always win those, but... I'm looking for, so what I'm seeing in this bill is there's no appeal. You just have to go back to the people who cut the rate.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I think it would be best to have the co-ops come up and describe that, how that's working in this process. Or Mr. Eloff, do you want to add anything onto it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think Representative Garofalo was correct when he said it could be taken to court on the basis that it was not reasonable as required by the law.
Damn, we're making lawyers richer and richer. I have some other questions, and I'll skip that one. I'll leave that one for...
Okay, I think if you're moving on to that subject, there's a couple of other people that may have questions on it. Representative Mahoney, if I could. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, my question, I think, is of Mr. Eloff. You indicated that these credits cancel at the end of the year. And my question is, what happens that last month? Do you get that credit at the beginning of the month, or does it come at the end of the month, and then where you literally have a matter of a day or hours to use your credits
Mr. Eloff.
To avoid cancellation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, as I read the language, in December you would be using credits that you had earned earlier in the year that carried over. If there were any left at the end of December, they would cancel to zero, and you would begin anew in January.
Yeah, so,
Representative
Chairman,
Carlson.
That was my point. I think if I'm understanding that correctly, then you basically would have to use 11 months because of the timing of that, because you wouldn't get the 12th month until the end of the month. And I don't know how quickly you could use those credits or when they would be credited to you. I'm not sure how much we're talking about here, but I think it's probably sounds like it's 11 months of credit, not really 12.
Sir, could you maybe enlighten us on this? Can you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, which represents the 44 distribution co-ops in the state and the 6 G&Ts that provide them power. As far as if a customer feels or one of our members feels that the rate that they're being charged is unfair, they can appeal to the board of directors that governs that co-op. If they don't, they don't get satisfaction there, they can appeal to the membership at the annual meeting. And if they still feel that they're not being heard, they can file a complaint with the Public Utilities Commission.
All right.
As far as the rollover provision, currently under law, utilities true up every month. Some will allow the credits to roll over. But what we're trying to address here is one of the, and this is pretty exclusive to electric co-op lines, is there have been a number of installations put up in empty fields, where they'll put up a shed with a single light bulb and then net meter that meter. So essentially what you're creating with that system is a system of merchant generators around the state that the co-ops have to buy electricity from. And with particular with wind, you're paying really above market prices for that energy. And it really isn't doing anything to actually net the use of a customer. So what this mechanism really is encouraging people to size their generation to what they actually use, as opposed to trying to generate income through it.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, going back to that rollover, now you said that many of the co-ops allow that to be rolled over. So what is your answer to the question I raised about the last month and the year, that when they get that credit at the end of the month, I assume? And are you telling me then that they could roll over that last month if they were using their credits for the first 11 months?
Mr. Johnson.
I think the way that the bill, the language is written, is those credits would expire at the end of the year. So, but most of the co-ops, and I believe also, I can't speak for the munis, but I believe this is true, most will not even let those credits expire. They will true up in some way or the other, but that will be left to the boards or the commissions that govern that specific utility.
Yeah, and Representative Carlson, what I'm picking up on is that the law says that they cancel, or that they don't roll over. So apparently it would be up to the good graces then of the utility to allow some sort of credit for that last month. Any idea on average what we're talking about here, 1 month's credit?
Mr. Johnson.
I think in certain situations with these smallers where they're not offsetting much load, those credits can amount to probably $700-$800 a month.
Okay, but Mr. Johnson, for the average homeowner who's got a rooftop solar system, I mean, what would you say the average amount is for that? I guess I ask because I have a rooftop solar system. I can't imagine it's very much money, but what would you say it is?
Mr. Chair, in most solar installations, they would not be affected by this at all, because you don't typically come close to matching the full load of that household.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, when I asked my question, the answer was on average 800. So what I was trying to figure out is what the economic impact would be if somebody did lose that last month, if they didn't exercise that credit, simply because it comes in on the 31st, if that would be possible to still exercise that credit before you, it's kind of a spend it or lose it kind of a situation the way the law is drafted. But I would view 800 on average as pretty significant.
Well, yeah, so would I, Representative Carlson, but I guess just based on what I know about it having a system of my own, this would be, someone who had an $800 credit, this would be a pretty large system that would be much larger than an average homeowner system, wouldn't it, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, that's correct. When I gave you that 800 figure, that would be a very good monthly income from a 39.9 kilowatt wind generator that isn't offsetting really any substantial load at that meter. So essentially what they're just getting paid the retail rate for the production off of that generator, and a check is being written for that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe,
Representative Carlson,
maybe that's something we can explore later, because I was asking on average, and now apparently there's quite the range, so I'm not sure what the answer is to on average. You're talking about the very small situation with a couple of panels or whatever, and apparently the answer in part is a larger provider or a larger system.
Mr. Johnson, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But at any rate, I don't know how many would have that kind of a system then at 800, but it would be at least significant for some people on average, is where I'll leave it, but we can talk more about it later.
Mr. Johnson, any other comments on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I wish I could give you an average, but particularly with small wind, the gap in output is really, really wide. Again, when I said that $700 to $800 range, that's a generator that's producing at pretty high capacity in a very good area. Most, as I mentioned before, most solar installations are well below 40 kW, typically around 4 kW in the typical household setting, and their rollover is going to be insignificant. They would use that in their monthly that it would offset their monthly use anyway. So
I think Mr. Chairman, to wrap it up, the problem is probably when I asked the question of an average, and maybe a better way to pose it at some point is a range then or something, that from small systems to relatively large systems and what the potential loss if they lose that last month would be.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to make a brief comment, and that is obviously this is one of the more controversial items in the bill. I've gotten a lot of feedback and a lot of concern from constituents about this, and I think what I'm really gathering from the conversation here and what I think we're going to see a lot more interest from consumers in who is serving on those boards. And I just want to say to the public that may be listening that what I'm getting from this, and I'm by no means, I have very little expertise in this area of policy, but what I'm gathering from the answers to Representative Carlson's questions and Representative Mahoney's questions is that these boards have a lot of power, and they are going to be making more decisions about how people are charged and how this is going to work. And so I would just say that I think consumers who are impacted by this are going to want to pay more attention to who is serving on those boards for municipal utilities and for co-ops. I'm very fortunate to, in my area, have Rochester Public Utilities, and they, in fact, opposed the change in this policy. So I think they're very supportive of people who want to go solar. I think there's a larger question here of, while I appreciate the answers I heard about, that this is trying to get people to just have their own enough for their own needs and not necessarily be trying to make money off of this. And yet the larger question, I think, is how quickly we move away from fossil fuels and so on, and how quickly we develop as a state, develop our solar energy resources. So I just would like to say to the public, heads up, you got to pay attention to who's serving on those boards.
Senator Latz.
Thank you. I want to change the subject if we're ready to go to the energy intensive trade exposed. I got some questions on that if it's appropriate to move on.
Sure, let's do that.
I just had a question, not sure who would be the right person to answer it, but I'm looking on page 80, starting at line 17, and the proposed statutory language there is really odd to me. Usually we don't have policy statements in statute unless it's really something that's necessary to guide judicial interpretation, if it were to come down to that. I'm not sure if that's the case here, but then to say that's the energy policy of the state to ensure competitive electric rates, I'd ask the question, competitive with whom? Competitive within other persons in the state, or competitive internationally, or other parts of the United States? And then to follow that up with the line, to achieve this objective, which is also very strange statutory language to propose, and then going on to that with a statutory change that it sets some new policy there, or some new language. Any idea where this language came from? What's the purpose of it? I mean, it's just not the kind of stuff you usually see in statute.
I guess Representative Garofalo or Senator Tomassoni, you want to take a crack at that?
Get some help here.
Senator Tomassoni.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, to your specific question, I'm going to have Mr. Brandt address it, but the as you're aware, the intent here is to provide some relief to the mining companies of the power rates that they are being charged because of the international competition that they're experiencing in a way that they've never experienced before. And because of the fact that they are such energy-intensive businesses, and they're as much as 25% to 30% of their cost base, that a reduction in power rates could mean a lot in the way of keeping the business running in Minnesota, as opposed to having to bring the steel or the ore in from another country. But as to your particular question as to why the statutory language, I'll see if there's an actual reason for it.
Mr. Chairman of the Joint Committee, can you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you. Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries, representing paper mills, sawmills, oriented strand board, and other segments of the forest products industry. To Senator Latz's question, the first sentence on 17 and 18, as I understand it, would be strictly or essentially to help provide some guidance to the PUC as they evaluate whatever gets proposed to them for subsequent action. And then the next sentences are a means of limiting the application to which investor-owned utilities, and essentially that would limit it to Minnesota Power and Otter Tail service territories. And I guess to the third question, I think there was a third question as to who, in terms of the competition, and this is my view, based on the competition that my industry members face. I mean, we face competition to keep the facilities running in Minnesota from international producers, from you know, be they Canada, be they Europe, be they Asia, and frankly, to keep our facilities running, sometimes we're in competition with other domestic manufacturers. But it would not be competition between facilities located here in Minnesota.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the most basic question to ask is whether this would make any difference when, from what I'm reading in the papers, the main reason for closures in northern Minnesota is the international decline in the market for what's being produced, especially with the steel. I mean, the worldwide prices for steel have dropped precipitously, and that's what the companies have been saying is the reason why they're just there's no demand out there for what they're producing, and whether these kind of changes in electricity rates are going to all of a sudden make these companies competitive. I guess I have a real question about the policy. But I've got another question, too, about the language. The reference on line 23 to new clean energy technology in the definitions, that does not include, for example, geothermal technology. Was there a reason that the definition was limited?
Mr.
Brandt?
Mr. Chair, and I guess to the previous question that you had, and I can't speak to the taconite's situation in the competition, but I can tell you, Senator and members of the committee, that when the housing market crashed, pardon me, here in the United States, and we went from 2.2 million housing starts down to under 600,000, quite frankly, some of the facilities in the building product side, particularly oriented strand board, their competition to keep producing in Minnesota was the other mills that the same company owned, be they in Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, or some of the provinces of Canada. So that the electrical cost on a marginal rate in my industry is highly significant, and we believe it will make a significant difference in allowing our operations to continue to run. To the question of geothermal, I mean, I can't tell you why geothermal is not in there. I mean, maybe nobody thought of it. I don't know that it's a significant producer of electricity from geothermal sources. I think the thought was to focus on electrical producing types of sources. So it may have been simply an oversight. I'm not familiar. Not sure.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 25, the language exempts a whole bunch of statutes and then directs the commission that they shall, upon a finding of net benefit to the utility. Can someone explain to me what that means, approve the a rate schedule? What does net mean? It says or the state, so they could ignore whether or not it benefits the state. It could be a terrible negative or detriment to the state, but if it benefits the utility, then they shall approve an EITE rate schedule. And I don't understand what net benefit to the utility means. Does it mean if the utility will make a profit based on the new rate schedule, then it's a benefit to them?
Mr. Chairman, Brent. Senator Latz, I think that this gets towards the issue of stranded costs in terms of the net benefit to the utility and to the state. You know, one of the significant and I think legitimate concerns out there is if one of these large loads, be they a taconite facility or a paper mill, goes under, the balance of the ratepayers are going to be on the hook for the capacity that was originally built and has been operated to service those loads. So I think that that is one of the considerations that would be directed to the Public Utilities Commission in evaluating it.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Latz,
based on the answer, it seems to me that the term utility ought to be replaced with ratepayers.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not learned enough in utility law, but I think that that would be the net benefit to the state. That would include the state would include the citizens of the state, you know, and that would be the ratepayers.
Well,
so that's just my guess.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Latz,
under the language here, they can ignore the benefit or no benefit to the state. And in fact, they're mandated to ignore the fact that it might be a detriment to the state if it's a net benefit to the utility. They shall approve the rate schedule. And perhaps even if you read this the right way, the rate schedule that the utilities have the ability to propose, shall have the ability to propose under lines 20 and 21. So I'm a little confused as to how that ends up necessarily benefiting the ratepayers, even if it ends up harming the state substantially. They are mandated to ignore the harm that might be created.
Well, Senator Tomasoni, Representative Groffel, aren't a lot of these cooperatives, so the ratepayers are the utility?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Or not in this case?
Investor-owned only.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up question, if I might.
Senator Latz.
On the cost recovery provision, down in lines, paragraph D,
mm-hmm.
It looks like the cost recovery exempts them from the energy-intensive trade-exposed customers will not participate in that cost recovery from the shift, and neither will the low-income residential ratepayers. So I take it that means that everyone else will be paying higher rates in order to subsidize these new lower rate schedules. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I think you have it just to the contrary of what the current situation is. The current situation is that the large industrials subsidize every other customer in the system. You know, the degree to which is subject to some discussion based on the different cost of services, service studies that are done by the PUC, by the utilities, and such. But it is, I believe, an incontrovertible fact that the taconites, the papers, the wood products, the large industrials subsidize all the others. We believe that what this provision in law, if enacted, will do is reduce the level of subsidy. So it's not like we're getting a deal out of this. The amount that we subsidize everybody else's costs, and thereby, frankly, not representing in the system the cost of the energy that other people actually use, which does encourage, on a market basis, conservation when you're paying the full rate of what you do. So the net effect of this will be to reduce the subsidies.
Okay, well, members, the DFL's having a caucus in this room at 6 o'clock, and I know there's a couple of other people that would like to ask questions, but I also think that we need to allow time to have the tables cleared and such, and I'm wondering if I could just, at this point, ask Representative Garofalo and Senator Tomasoni if they've got any last comments they'd like to make.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say to Senator Latz on the energy intensive stuff that we have Gwatin Taconite and U.S. Steel and Mintec both have laid off workers. U.S. Steel at Mintec is much bigger than at Keytec, but we're being told that this particular incentive could potentially keep a plant open and save it from being closed. We don't know if
that's true or not, but the fact of the matter is it's really difficult to risk that it might be true. And when you have another scram mining operation like Magnetation laying off people and closing a plant, and then you have Mesabi Nugget, which is a new value-added technology closing and saying they're going to be closed for 2 years, you realize the seriousness of the situation within the industry. As to the bill, I've said this before. Oftentimes when you have to compromise on things, somebody gets one thing and somebody gets another thing, and some people are happy and some people aren't, and oftentimes you end up in the middle where nobody is happy, and I guess that's the art of compromise. But the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of good things in the bill, and would it be my intention to have other things in the bill that aren't in the bill? I'm disappointed there's some things that aren't in the bill, yes, and I would like to have more funding in the bill, but I believe that we've gotten to a point where the bill has been vetoed. Many of the governor's concerns have been responded to. There's been funding put in places that he had some very serious concerns about, and I think we fixed some things that were lacking in the bill. And so I'm just asking everybody to support the bill and pass it out of here and make sure people aren't put out of work.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill spends $24 million less than the previous budget for this committee budget. It's about a 5% reduction, and I would ask members for support of it.
Okay, well, members, I know Representative Mahoney, Senator Bonhoff, I know that you had some other questions, and I wish I could go on to them, but again, we need to clear the room for the caucus that's going to be in here. I can only ask that you ask any questions you have to the two chairs, and or else ask them on the floor.
The chair.
Representative Mahoney, do you have something you have to say?
Yeah.
All right. Well, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, this was supposed to be the session of Greater Minnesota. You have $10 million in broadband when we did 20 for 2 years. When we did $20 million the year before that, you had the business most this inside baseball with BDPI. Somebody claimed that they were going to do $5 or $10 or $15 million. You ended up doing $3 million, and you earmarked almost half of it for the first year for Cambridge and Taylor's Falls in this bill. So, I mean, there's nothing in there for these Greater Minnesota economic development people to actually start working on projects in their districts. There's something in the bonding bill, but that's all publicly owned pieces. Your housing issue here that everybody wanted to talk about and came into the early session, so I'm trying to be done here, so I had a better speech. You came in with 10, 20, 30, 40 million dollars worth of housing, and you end up with $4 million at deed and $2 million for Greater Minnesota housing. And when you put $4 million at deed, you're subsidizing people housing. You're buying down the cost of development for people who make earn a living of over $62,500 a year. Because why? I don't know why. Why am I subsidizing? Why is the metro area subsidizing people in Greater Minnesota's housing that earn more than $62,000?
Okay, Representative Horne, I thought you had a last question for them, but I guess
no, but I think this is the place that people need to start to understand what's in the bill. I mean, you put a bill up at 3:50 this afternoon saying that this is going to be a new bill. Obviously, it was a noontime bill, and we're supposed to go into session tomorrow, and people don't hear. The people in the state of Minnesota don't have any clue what's in this bill, and in Greater Minnesota, they got screwed in this particular deal that they cut with you guys. So I'm a little offended, and I think the citizens of Greater Minnesota should be told that they got nothing in broadband, they got nothing in their housing, they got all sorts of earmarks in this jobs bill, and they're not going to get the economic development that you guys promised them.
Again, that was not a question that I thought you were going to ask, but it's only fair at this point for me to give the authors a chance to have the last word. That's what we usually do in custom and usage around here. Representative Garofalo or Senator Tomasoni, do you want to respond to Representative Mahoney?
You want to go first? Well, Mr. Chairman, as I said, I would have written the bill differently, but
we did.
But there's a compromise that ended up, and there was a veto involved, and this is what came back from the negotiations after the veto, and I can't say that I'm 110% happy with what happened, but I'm willing to vote for this bill and to pass it because of the need to get these agencies funded and to make sure that the people that work for these agencies aren't laid off on June 30th, and that's part of our job and part of what happens with compromises that some people aren't happy, and Representative Mahoney expressed his opinion very well.
Representative Garofalo?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, if you're upset about earmarks and you think that too much money is going to big business, I would suggest you offer an amendment to eliminate the $4 million subsidy for Chinese-owned Cirrus that's in the bill. You have that opportunity as a member if you're really that upset about it.
Okay. Members, thank you. There will be other opportunities to ask questions on the floor. Meeting's adjourned.